Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
It's time for Radio Vermont's News and Public Affairs program, Open Mic with Hester Fuller. The phone lines to speak with Hester are open at 802-244-1777 and toll-free 1-877-291-8255. And here's your host, Hester Fuller.
Thank you so much, Tom. Good morning. I hope everybody had a wonderful weekend. How was your weekend, Tom? Was it a good time?
I worked all weekend.
Well, that's not bad.
Here yesterday, haven't done that for, this used to be my old shift back in the 90s, mm-hmm. And then I was down at Du Bois Construction. We had a wonderful remote. Weather was good,
mm-hmm.
So I had a good weekend, though.
Good weekend. I went to the Vermont Dog Festival.
That is over in, that was up north,
up in Enosburg,
right?
Yeah.
Yes, how was that?
It was awesome.
Great.
I brought my little guy, and we went around. We saw all kinds of fabulous critters, dogs. A friend of mine took her great big Malamute in for a canine good citizenship ribbon and earned it. And so was a little cause for celebration.
Yeah.
And my buddies from work at Vermont Dog Boarding and Behavior, we're all there representing. But it was really a wonderful, wonderful event with lots and lots of folks and lots of different little sort of fun competitions. But mainly it was fun just to go around and see all the amazing four-legged critters there. It was really great.
Well, good to hear.
So hands off. Hats off to those folks who put on the Vermont Dog Festival. Appreciated the really good time. Quite the day coming up, quite the week coming up, in fact. Tonight, of course, attention, ears, go down to Hempstead, Long Island, Hofstra University, which will be the site of the first of a couple, debates from the top of the ticket this year. And in just a little bit, we will be checking in with my friend James Blue, who is a content producer for PBS NewsHour, and he's down there now setting up, getting ready. Those of you who are tuning in to this program during the primaries, remember James talking during the debates amongst the primary candidates and his very thoughtful views about the role of media in all of this. And I think it's a really timely thing to check back in with him tonight on some of those topics. He's looking for your questions and calls, too. So I'm going to give those phone numbers once again, 244-1777 or toll-free 1-877-291-8255. That's the number, and we look forward to hearing from you as always. You know that makes my Monday morning when you guys call in, because that's how I know what to be paying attention to in the days and weeks going forward. In our second hour, we're going to remember David Budbill. I did not know him, but I have been really kind of attached at the hip to his work for probably 30 years, and I'm looking forward to some reflections on his life and work with someone who did know him. Rusty DeWeese will be in, and we will together remember David Budbill, and I'm looking forward to that as well. Right now, though, looking for your calls. Give us a call, 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. We'll put you in touch with Open Mic here on WDEV. We're here Monday through Friday. I'm in the chair on Mondays, and good old Mike Smith is here from Tuesday through Friday in this seat. And we hold down the fort every weekday morning from 9 to 11 when Bill Sayre pops in with Common Sense Radio. And that's a program brought to you by the Ethan Allen Institute. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre every weekday morning at 11 here on WDEV. Whoops. There we go. Should be hearing from James fairly soon. We seeing any no ding-a-lings yet? Huh?
Not yet, but I think you said about 9:15.
Yeah, he'll be
got a few moments.
Yeah, he'll be calling in. What are your expectations for this evening, Tom? Are you going to be tuning in for this?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
You know, I guess I'm gonna. If I don't, I'm sure there'll be plenty of replays all night and tomorrow. But as far as predicting it, like the rest of the season mm-hmm. has been, the political season, who knows?
We'll just have to see. I'm inclined to either watch it on PBS or watch it on C-SPAN, because then you can watch these things without the commentary, the punditry. That sort of drives me nuts. I don't like being told what to think. I really resent being told what to think about, but that's kind of what media does, is point your attention in particular directions. I really don't like to be told what I should be thinking of what I am hearing and seeing.
You can listen to it tonight. You're on WD.
That's right. Nine, oh, my gosh. Then, mortification sets in. Yes, of course.
So then, of course, you know, you can listen and maybe enjoy some cider and by the fire, because it seems to be getting cold.
I know. I fired up the wood stove for the first time this week, and I wonder how many other people did. That's a smell I love. You know, when the first time you fire up the wood stove, that smell of the hot iron and the embers, the wood. Oh, I forget every year how much I love that, and then I have that experience again, and I remember that there's a couple good things to like about the cold weather.
But
I'm sort of a hot weather freak, so this transition is tough.
We had a nice fire up at my father's last night. He's a fireplace, one of those old, you know, where it's all exposed. But,
nice.
You know, it's kind of nice.
It's
good. And, of course, and I had to turn on the heat on Saturday for the first time since May, which is always, yeah, here we go.
I just pile the critters on the bed and cuddle up and get a good book, and I'm good.
It was freezing in my house, so I had no choice.
Mm-hmm.
But that's okay, you know. Hey, we had a nice summer. It's not, well, it is over technically, but I bet we have another few.
But even if we don't, you know, this time of year is also not without its splendors, you know.
How's the foliage up your way?
It's starting to turn. Of course, the peaches on sticks out in front of my alpaca barn start turning kind of in late July. And now one of them's completely turned, and then there's little signs on the others that's contagious, it's catching.
Yeah.
So it won't be too long. But.
Seems late, though. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's not getting cold as quick. Who knows? It was pretty darn warm this summer. And I think the amount of rain has something to do with it as well. We should get Roger Hill or some other scientist sort of person in on this program to talk a bit about that. And I think we will do that as foliage season wades in. In the meantime, we'd love to know what you guys are thinking about. Give us a call at 244-1777 or toll free 1-877-291-8255. Candidates are very busy managing expectations at this point for tonight's debate. We'll just have to see how that works out for them, and it'll be interesting to find out from James Blue what he sees and hears going on down there. That's where he is. He's down at Hempstead, Long Island, at Hofstra University, where PBS is setting up its coverage. Interestingly, there'll be a lot of different... This coverage is not exclusive to any one particular network, which I gather is an interesting situation for the advertising marketers. It's kind of depressed the prices they can get for these spots because advertisers have so many options at this point to choose from. That's kind of curious. It's sort of beside the point, but it's interesting, I think.
And, of course, how far we've come since the JFK-Nixon debate.
Oh, yeah,
when the first one, that was the first time that was really televised. So, mm-hmm. Of course, it would be interesting if people listen to us tonight on WDEV. At 9 tonight, mm-hmm. Listen to it on the radio, then go watch the highlights and see if your impression of what you hear matches up with what you see.
With what you see, that's right. And just see, I mean,
it's an experiment.
It's a good object lesson in how the media edit reality. And they do it all the time. There's no way avoiding that. There's no way to avoid it. If you're in media, you know it's a constant business of making choices. And whatever it is that fuels those choices, you have to be conscious of trying to be at least balanced, possibly not equal time, but certainly balanced. I try to make no secret of where my sympathies lie, but I try not to let that get in the way of airing different points of view on the various issues that come before us, and I hope to continue that this morning. I'd love to hear from my listeners, though, because they always are thought-provoking, and they make me consider points of view that I would certainly not have come up with on my own. So I do encourage you to call in, 244-1777, or 1-877-291-8255. Dana from Montpelier, good morning.
Yes, hi, Esther.
Hi.
I just wanted to give you a compliment. You do a wonderful job on the radio.
You're awful nice to say that.
I love your open-mindedness, and you let people talk. I just moved back to Vermont about 6 months ago, and I fell in love with you. Well, anyways.
Now I'm blushing.
On the debate, I think the most important thing that's going to come out of the debate is who has the best plan to create jobs in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I see so many people hurting out here. And I came from Connecticut, another state that has an extremely high unemployment rate. And I moved back to Vermont because it was much easier to find work up here, although mm-hmm. very hard to find work up here. But at least there's a possibility up here. In Connecticut, forget it.
Well, you know, it's funny because in Vermont, the unemployment rate is really quite low. It's below the national average at this point.
yeah. I found it, well, at my age, I'm not young anymore. At my age, I found it difficult, but at least I am working now. And there's many more possibilities out there. I just redid my resume, et cetera. But I think the most important thing for the country now is jobs.
Yeah.
And I think whoever articulates that position tonight will win the debate.
I think that's interesting, an interesting point of view. I think that's the issue that seems to so often drive national political races, is something to do with the economy. What do you think the foreign policy stuff is going to mean in terms of tonight's discussion? I think that's probably most people would concede.
Foreign policy, I believe, who articulates the best, I guess you could go back to maybe FDR, you know, in 1940, 41. I think maybe a little bit isolationism might win the debate on that. I just really don't think we can afford any more wars. And, of course, they're both saying no boots on the ground, I believe. But politicians have said that before, and, you know.
Yeah, we know how it goes. Of course, technology's advanced in some very frightening ways since over the course of this particular conflict.
I think really Hillary Clinton will have trouble if Donald Trump brings up NAFTA and GATT that was passed under her husband's administration that cost middle class workers about 4.5 million jobs.
Now, when you say that, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but now you've made me think of a question. I'm really curious about your point of view on this. When you say that she will come in for some trouble if Trump brings up things that happened under her husband's administration, do you feel like that's just that's sort of at the political level of this, or do you think that that she really is legitimately to be called for account for things that were done under a different administration?
If she takes his position on possibly reversing NAFTA, like Trump is, without crashing the economy. It has to be done very carefully, I believe. But if she takes that position, I think she's okay. But I don't know if she will. I don't know if she will, because I don't know. That's a sticky topic. I'm going to be interested to see if that topic's brought up tonight.
Now, you mentioned you really feel that whoever articulates the point of view on jobs that resonates is really going to, quote-unquote, win the debate. Is that the thing you're particularly listening for, to make distinctions between these candidates? Or what are you personally listening for?
That's what I'm in tune to, I just think that, 2008 was the peak of the recession, 2009, eight, around there. And it's been very slow coming back. I mean, I don't know. I just see a lot of hurting people, you know, out there, even younger people. I mean, granted, I'm much older. I was born in '56, but I mean, I just see the person that has the best plan to possibly create jobs in this country, I think will win the debate. I really do.
Well, I really appreciate your calling in, and maybe we can touch base next Monday and just see how we all did Monday morning. Next week, we'll Monday morning quarterback this Monday and see how it came in. Dana, thank you so much for calling from Montpelier. Look forward to hearing from you again. Let's zip up to Huntington, where Rich is on the line. Rich, what are you thinking about this morning?
Good morning, Hester. Well, as long as you're talking about the debates, I could never figure out why that people are always fixated on the idea that this debate, any political debates, are a competitive event and there has to be a winner and a loser. I've always thought of these things as an informational thing because, of course, everyone, your candidate always wins the debate anyway. So.
Fair enough. I hadn't thought of it that way, but yeah.
But I know they turn them into a Hollywood spectacular. And to me, the ideal political debate, especially in our case of our very divided country, is you have the thing in an empty room. Absolutely no audience participation, or preferably no audience. I don't know what purpose it serves to have an audience in a debate.
Well, it's kind of like the gladiators in Rome, you know? The people.
Well, I mean, that was intended to be a...
That's right.
I mean, that's what it's turned into. It's, like I say, it takes it away from it being an informational thing. And absolutely, both participants or all participants should be given the same questions and have given the exact same amount of time to respond. I mean, it needs to be just an informational thing. They've turned it into such a Dancing with the Stars kind of a thing. You know?
Excellent analogy. With the idea that it should be informational, and I don't disagree with that at all, it would be nice to have one clear forum where I could really hear. what do we do with a candidate like Mr. Trump, who seems to have, let's just call it, a loose relationship with reality on a number of issues that matter to Americans? How informational can it be if he's going to play fast and loose with the facts?
Well, see, we're all biased, and I would have to say that it is Hillary who has a fast and loose relationship with the truth. I mean, like I said, you ask the same question, you let them respond. There doesn't need to be any follow-up.
Do you think there needs to be fact-checking, though? Do you think there's when assertions are made that basically fly in the face of the record, should somebody be there to point that out, or should that fall back on consumers to
not during the debate? Let the buyer beware. I mean, obviously, there's going to be the Monday morning quarterbacking, and there will be fact checking afterwards. I mean, that's part of what the informational thing is.
Yeah.
If it comes out that half of what one of the candidates says was not factual, it will come out the next day, and that will be part of their blemished record. You know, is misrepresenting the truth.
Well, I would love to believe that that was the case. You know, sometimes, though, I think that people aren't as tuned in the day after. They're much more interested in what people think than what really happened. And the fact-checking that doesn't happen right on the spot is fact-checking is an opportunity lost completely.
Well, have you ever seen a debate where they did fact-checking? And, I mean, it gets down into the moderator being biased again. Mm. And you and I obviously don't see things the same way as far as the two candidates here. But there can be a lot of bias introduced when you bring up a point. Hey, you can't make that statement or
Fair enough. No, I hear where you're going with that, and I don't disagree with that either. I'm thinking there may be a role for alternative media in that part of it. I mean, using the web, using other places that sort of lend themselves to something other than instant judgments.
Yeah, that will happen, but it will happen after the debate. I mean, if someone comes out with totally fictitious data. I mean, you're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts. And these things will come out later. You know, whether you choose to read about it in the McNews USA Today or in, you know, Politico or online sources.
Well, you're an optimistic man, and I really hope you're right. And, Rich, I want to thank you. We have a little bit of a backlog of calls piling up here, so I need to let you go, but I hope you will call us back again. Love to hear what you think. In the aftermath, next week we'll probably be talking a bit about this. And, Rich, I really appreciate your calls. You're making me see things in a different way. Thank you very much. Rob from North Carolina, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Hester.
What's
I think we're all going to see things perhaps in a different way.
Well, I hope so.
Some small ways or big ways, but you know, you said Trump is loose with the relationship with reality, and then Rich said, I think, no, it's Hillary who has a loose relationship with the truth, which is another way of saying reality. So, you know, that's where we stand. I mean, there's a trust issue for those who oppose Trump. There's a trust issue for those who oppose Hillary. And this whole thing of fact-checking, I don't think there's any place for the moderator to step in because, you know, the press plays loosey-goosey with the facts sometimes. So does Hillary and so does Trump. So, you know, to say that the all-knowing guy who's running the debate or woman who's running the debate is going to set everybody straight on what the actual truth is, I think the people who are watching, if they have a problem with what Trump says, you know, they got their, if they have a real problem, they got their phones, their smartphones right in front of them. They can do it themselves. We don't need, you know, a nanny there to tell you, oh, that's not right, Hillary, that's not right. I don't want a fact checker there correcting Hillary or Trump. I want to see how they handle with the other person's response, whether it be truth or a shades of the truth or not.
Right. You know, Rob, I completely agree with you. And the other thing that occurred to me as you were speaking is that how in the world could somebody like Lester Holt actually do any fact-checking if he's doing his job right there moderating the debate? I mean, it's just logistically it would be impossible to be doing that.
Exactly. Let
it be.
Let the personalities come out. Let's see how they handle each other under pressure. This whole thing about putting Mark Cuban in the front row, which was Hillary's idea, I guess, you know, the co-chair of the presidential debate was on a Carnish yesterday, and he said this is a bad idea. They don't want anyone to try to put someone in front who's going to serve as a kind of a disruptor for the other person, and that's what Rich was saying. let's get the audience out of this. They shouldn't even be there. I hope that Hillary and Trump don't have any view of the audience. I hope they're, like, blacked out so that, you know, there's not some eye contact going on. I don't even know. What do you think? Is there going to be some eye contact with the front row?
I really wonder. I don't know how they're going to set it up. And, you know, when James Blue calls in, that's something we can ask him. And I think that's a really good question. And I will put that to him if he can tell us a bit about the layout of the scene there, because he's right there. And he can tell us whether... A, whether they'll have eye contact, and B, whether there's any update on who may or may not be occupying those front row seats. I think that's a completely legitimate point of view on you know, the way these things work out, and I really thank you very much for calling in with that point of view. Jay from Montpelier, you're on the air on Open Mic this morning.
Hi, it's Jerry.
Oh, it's Jerry. Hi, Jerry. What's up?
That's okay. Hey, I have to agree with the gentleman that called earlier. There's no winner. This debate is not about a winner or a loser. It's about information about the candidates that people can make their decisions on, you know, to vote for. Now, I have a question. Do you really actually think people haven't made their decisions already?
Good point. I have made my decision, and I'm not, you know, ashamed to say that.
I basically have too. My decision is probably for the first time in my life, and the gentleman also made me feel old because I was born in 1955.
So was I.
Great.
We'll be old. Yeah. We'll grow old together, Jerry.
So, anyways, my decision might be not to vote.
I'm
so disgusted that this country can't find a candidate that is qualified, not through nepotism, and available to be a president through education and make us proud of our country again. I'm embarrassed.
I hear you. I'm going to agree to disagree with you on the question of whether to vote or not, because in my mind, there's no question. The candidates are not equally bad. But you know what? I have to hold that thought. And Dottie from Craftsbury, we know you're on the line as well. But my guest, James Blue, is now joining us from Hempstead, Long Island. Morning, James.
Good morning. And actually, Hester, I'm not on site. I thought I would be this morning. I'm in Arlington, Virginia, which is where we are putting on our program tonight.
Oh, boy.
Largely, we decided, you know, why do we need to travel our anchors to Hempstead when we're getting all of this back into our studio?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm here for the long haul till 11 o'clock tonight.
Well, excellent. But I would imagine, though, in setting up the broadcast, you have some idea of sort of the lay of the land and like how they're going to set up the set and where the audience is relative to the speakers. That's an issue that's come up in our conversation this morning with listeners.
Yeah, it's a very small audience, about 250 people. There will be no applause, cheering, or any type of reaction.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a big departure point from the debates that they held during the primary season.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other thing that is different, you know, the moderator is really there just to kind of move things along. And I think, you know, we'll sort of see, there's this big question, will Lester Holt fact check and will he hold them accountable? Mm-hmm. My sense of just sort of looking at some of the stuff that Lester Holt's done in the past, and if you think about the moderator, it's really giving the candidates a chance to do that type of work.
Mm-hmm.
And so my sense...
You mean to call each other on statements that they would dispute?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Versus trying to do that himself.
Mm-hmm.
I also think it's very difficult given, you know, all the stuff that he wants to get through in terms of themes and topics. You know, he's just not going to be able just sort of mentally to be able to be fact checker in chief.
Sure. Yeah, that was something... That dawned on me as I was discussing that with a caller. I mean, logistically, how could you do that? Your brain can't be in six things at once.
And I think it's perfectly reasonable to expect the candidates to be able to do that themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We actually have a caller who's been hanging in there for a bit from Craftsbury, and I'd like to cut away and take a question from her, and maybe, James, you'll have something to say. Dottie.
No problem.
Dottie from Craftsbury. Hi.
Well, I'm wondering about the number three man, Gary Johnson.
Mm.
Why he has a campaign to let Gary debate, and he's got a million signatures of people that want him to debate.
And you feel it's not fair that he not be there. Is that what I'm getting from you? Yeah.
With people hemming and hawing about Hillary and Trump, it would be nice to hear someone else. You said a while back, or your friend did, that there was no choice, but there is. Mm-hmm. And since he was governor, a Republican governor in New Mexico in a Democratic state, and they reelected him, and his running mate, Bill Welk, from a Republican governor in Massachusetts in a Democratic state, and he was reelected. So I think right there, they're doing something right, and they're bipartisan, and I would like to listen to him.
I hear you. James, do you have any thoughts for Dottie about the how this is coming about? And I'm sure that's a question you guys wrestle with also.
No, we do, and there are very particular rules. So I'm upset that Dottie is upset that Johnson won't be on the stage. But in order to make the stage, there are very specific rules that require a candidate to reach a threshold nationally over a period of time to be able to join the two main party candidates. And despite the enthusiastic support that Governor Johnson has, both from his campaign supporters and the folks who wanted to bring him onto the debate stage, his poll numbers, although they are strong, were not strong enough to meet that threshold. And I think the threshold is 15% or more in like 3 or 4 national polls over a 2-week period.
Mm-hmm.
And he just doesn't qualify mm-hmm. on that basis.
Mm-hmm.
And I, in a way, I think Gary Johnson is not going to be the next president. That's just not very, very, it's not possible, it's not likely, it's not going to happen. And so I think it probably would be, better for folks to focus on the conversation and the debate between between the presidential candidates of the two major parties, and that's what's going to happen tonight.
Now, just you can refresh our memories a bit. Who is it that does set the rules for this occasion tonight?
So the rules are set by the Commission on Presidential Debates, which is a bipartisan group chaired by Frank Fahrenkopf, who was an RNC chair back in the 1980s during the Reagan years, and Mike McCurry, who was President Clinton's first director of communications. And so it is a really sort of bipartisan, non-political group. We've worked with them on a number of occasions, and they take the role pretty seriously and have worked very hard to make sure that there is no sort of political bias mm-hmm. within the setup. And, unfortunately, I know a lot of your listeners who may be supporting Gary Johnson or Jill Stein don't want to necessarily hear that they don't qualify, because it doesn't in any way change the way they feel about their candidate. But they, not enough people across the country for a sustained period of time feel similarly, which is why neither of them are on stage.
Speaking with James Blue from PBS NewsHour, who is calling us, they are, of course, providing coverage this evening of the presidential debate from Hofstra University, Hempstead, Long Island. James, we need to stop for a little bit of a break, and I wonder if you could just hang on briefly. I would love to talk with you about this business of fact-checking and the role of other media. I know PBS is mounting an effort on the web, and I'd love to hear from you about what you guys see the role of that website to be. Is that okay? Can you hang in?
Absolutely.
All
go
right.
for it.
We'll be back right after these words on Open Mic. Good morning and welcome back to Open Mic on WDEV, where it's about 23 minutes in front of 10 o'clock. My guest right now is James Blue, who's a producer from PBS NewsHour, speaking to us from Arlington, Virginia, where they are setting up for this evening's broadcast of the big debate, the presidential debate, which will actually emanate from Hempstead, New York, and Hofstra University. James, a number of our callers this morning have taken issue with the idea that fact-checking needs to be a part of the actual process of the debate, or that the moderator should have any role in this. It seems to me this is a prime opportunity for alternative media in this digital age to be helping with that problem.
Well, look, I think obviously media from all points of view and, you know, right up the middle are going to assess, you know, the facts that come out of each candidate's mouth.
Actually, I'm not thinking. I'm not so much thinking of that kind of alternative. I'm thinking of digital media, really, as an alternative to TV and radio.
Well, yeah, and so it's interesting you say that, because that's not a distinction we make. Even though we have a one-hour program every day, we constantly turn stuff out onto the web, onto our digital platforms. And so during the course of the debate, if you go to the PBSNewsHour.org, you will see our blog, which will sort of constantly be updating our viewers on sort of what we think is truthful and untruthful. So I do think there is the possibility for media to evaluate the veracity of what the candidates are saying, you know, as we sort of go through the debate. Just over the weekend, I think Politico did an analysis of sort of the candidates and found that, you know, Donald Trump had many more falsehoods and untruths than Secretary Clinton. I don't think that's necessarily a surprise. Mm-hmm. I think the challenge is, what is the response to that?
Mm-hmm.
And what do we as news organizations, you know, do? I think four news organizations called Donald Trump a liar over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times, Politico, The Washington Post, and the L.A. Times.
Well,
not to mention
the New York Times' piece, you know, on why he would actually be dangerous.
Yeah, that's from the editorial page, and I'm just talking from the actual news coverage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see what I'm saying? But you're right.
Yes.
The editorial page absolutely did say he would be dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual newspaper side of the newspaper actually called him a liar.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are very significant moments in our sort of history of covering campaigns, and in my mind, unprecedented.
And the idea of using the digital platform as a venue, I mean, people can kind of be watching and checking tablets or phones or whatever to...
Yeah, our sense is that people, you know, we are no longer, you know, we're no longer a one-device world. And mm-hmm. so very few people simply watch TV, you know, in isolation. And as a result, you know, whereas you used to have these spin rooms, the spin room is going to be online and on Twitter the entire time the debate goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And so it'll be virtually impossible, I think, for the candidates' handlers to come out after the debate and sort of shape it and spin it as they want, because all that will have happened, I think, during the course of the debate in the sort of social media world.
You raised an interesting point a little while ago when we were talking about facts and who's going to, maybe it was a caller who raised it, but I feel like we're in an age now where facts appear to matter less and less to many people. Do you have that sense?
I don't think so. I still think facts matter because the facts are what give you a basis to form opinions and judgments. And, you know, I think some people have different interpretations, but you know, I do think facts matter, and the fact that we're even discussing do facts matter suggests that they still do matter.
Mm-hmm.
I think the departure point is, what do you do based on a set of realities? And it'll be very interesting tonight to see whether Lester Holt can get the candidates to agree on, you know, two similar views of reality.
Mm. And that actually brings me to, I know you've got to scoot pretty quickly, but I am curious, what is it that you personally are watching for tonight? Is there any one thing?
No, I just think, you know, we're all watching to see, you know, Donald Trump's never debated for 90 minutes. Hillary Clinton has always been, you know, very prepared. Just waiting to see, you know, sort of how they do. I mean, one of the things that I would really strongly encourage your audience to tune into we, in collaboration with Microsoft, have just produced a website, watchthedebates.org, which chronicles all the past general election debates from 1960, with highlights by topic and by year, which sort of show you what previous general election debates have been like. And I think what you will find is that style, approach, and demeanor have often been much more important than what they actually say. And so, you know, it's watchthedebates.org, and it's a wonderful resource, and people can actually rate the previous debates. You can see the live debates there this evening, if that's where you prefer to watch, and you can interact with the material in a way that we're pretty excited about.
Well, that sounds like a really great resource, and I really want to thank you very much for being with us this morning, and good luck tonight, and I hope we can touch base with you again as the season
I'm sure it will happen.
All right, James, take care.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. You are listening to Open Mic here on WDEV. Love to hear your thoughts. We've been speaking with James Blue, who's a producer for PBS NewsHour. They're getting ready for their broadcast this evening, and they've been working with Microsoft on a really interesting digital resource for folks to have a kind of at the ready as they listen to the candidates respond to the questions from moderator Lester Holt. If you've got thoughts or you would like to tell us how you plan to spend the evening watching the debate, maybe not, 244-1777 is one number you can use. You can also call us toll-free, 1-877-291-8255, and we'd surely love to hear from you. I think we have another call. Oh, Fred from Newbury. How are you doing this week, Fred?
Okay. Hey, it looks like that Trump is going to be, if he becomes president, the 21st version of Calvin Coolidge.
Really? That's an interesting take.
You don't know anything about Calvin Coolidge?
I know a little bit about him, but I want to hear what you know.
He was a great president. His administration cleaned up corruption in government when he was there, and when he left, the budget was less than we came into the presidency, and he balanced the budget. I mean, it was incredible what that guy did. And he gets nobody, everybody's forgotten about him. It's unbelievable.
Well, I think we owe you a,
you can see.
We owe you a big thank you then for bringing him to our attention. What makes you see Trump as sort of an equivalent to old Silent Cal? He's not silent.
Okay, he wants to clean up corruption in the federal government, and he wants to balance the budget. I mean, that's what he wants to do.
And well, if wishes were horses, Calvin, you know.
Coolidge had unprecedented growth for a decade after, from the beginning of his, well, after he left office, that's what it was. Those his policies put into effect tremendous growth for the next 10 years after he left office.
That was a different world, too, though, wasn't it? It was a very different kind
of
world.
Yeah, different world. But guess what? Everything is relative. You know that.
Right, but help me make the connection you're making there. I'm not sure I follow you.
Everything's relative.
What does that
right?
mean? What does that have to do with your argument?
You can compare yesterday with today, but it's relative. What was going on yesterday was very important, like what's going on today. You can't compare them. You can't compare them.
Well, what gives you the confidence then that the kinds of things that Mr. Trump has said he wants to have happen, A, will happen, or B, would really have the impact that you expect them to have?
Well, the problem with that is it's going to be difficult for him to do it if he doesn't win the Senate and the House.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's going to have a hard time doing it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, there's three branches of government, and it's going to be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he's going to have the bully pulpit, so he could go around and around the country and just say, look, I'm being stonewalled by the Congress of the United States, and the only people that can help me are the voters. So you got to go out there and you got to help me, you got to write letters, call, do this and that. And maybe that could make a big difference.
Well, you know, it always makes a difference, I think, when people do get up off their tushes and get themselves involved and take action. Are you planning to vote?
Oh, yeah, I'm planning to vote.
Excellent. That's great.
I think this is going to be the highest turnout in, say, the last cycles.
Well, you know what? I sure hope you're right, Fred. I hope we get a huge turnout. And I want to thank you for calling, and I look forward to your call every week. So I hope you'll be checking in with us again next week here on Open Mic. Mary from Randolph, you have thoughts on the topic of the day.
Hi, good morning, Hester.
Good morning.
Yes, and I was very interested to listen to James's explanation about why Gary Johnson is not included in mm-hmm. the debate, and I'm sorry to hear that. You know, it'd be great to hear another view mm-hmm. and his experience as a governor and his success as a governor, I think, is very applicable.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a couple of thoughts tonight. I won't be watching. I don't have cable, but I will be looking on my computer if I can get any updates.
Well, you can listen on WDEV, too.
Oh, good. Yep. Okay, great. But I'm really kind of hoping that, I don't like to wish bad things for people, but I do hope that Trump implodes tonight upon himself and shows his true colors. So that people actually maybe wake up and see what we're dealing with here. It's a bit frightening to
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm kind of hoping for, that he shows his true colors. I am definitely voting.
Mm-hmm.
It's our one, I don't know, I feel not as powerful, with my vote because I don't know that my voice is being heard, but I'm going to vote. So that's my thought.
Okay, Mary, thanks very much for calling in. We have another caller from Bristol. Good morning. You're on open mic.
Sorry, Hester, they were breaking up and they dropped.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah, we have a bit of a problem when folks call in on cell phones or other less than stable connections, and we don't want our listeners to have to kind of fight their way through the static to hear your point. So sometimes we have to let you go for that reason, and we apologize for that. It doesn't mean we don't want to hear from you. We would love to hear from you. So give us a call on a stable line at 244-1777 or toll-free 1-877-291-8255.
We actually have, there's a fellow that is in this vehicle. I didn't quite catch his name. We're going to try to patch him through right now.
Okay. He's not driving while he's talking on his cell phone, is he?
I guess we'll find out. I don't know. Here we go.
Okay. Hi, are you there?
Yes, through the miracle of Bluetooth.
Oh, boy. I'm worried, though. I don't want to be aiding and abetting a criminal act here.
No, it's not a criminal act. It's not handheld.
Okay, that's good to know. Tell us where you're calling from. Well, I guess you're calling from the road, but...
Well, yeah, I'm on the road on the way to Burlington.
Okay.
And I was just trying to, in the sense of fact-checking, your gentleman from PBS forgot one... Well, he kind of hinted to it. It's a bipartisan commission.
Mm-hmm.
So only the two major parties are on that commission to set...
All I have is...
What? Oh.
You back?
Yes, I'm back.
Okay. Your friend at PBS was saying that it's a bipartisan commission, which
yes.
is true. It's made up of the two parties. It used to be the League of Women Voters, so it was then that you had the third parties, and the rules were set that way.
Mm-hmm.
They could set the rules. And I think with bipartisan, the two major parties, of course they're going to lock out the third party candidates. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I just find that... I'd like to hear those third-party views, especially Mr. Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I've made my mind up one way or the other, but just to be able to hear the different ideas and make my mind up, because I am not pleased with the two major party candidates.
Well, you know, and another piece of that is that the candidates would hear this third point of view, and they'd have to kind of bounce off that and respond to that as well. And I think
absolutely, mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, listen, thanks a lot for calling, and we actually have to go and take care of a little bit of business, so I have to let you go, but I hope you call us back again sometime. Those of you who have thoughts on the debates and what's going on tonight down in Long Island, give us a call, 244-1777, or toll-free 1-877-291-8255. We'll be right back after these words on Open Mic. Good morning and welcome back to Open Mic. Hester Fuller is my name. You are tuned to WDEV Radio, and the topic right now, the debate coming up this evening from Hofstra University. We've been hearing from callers about what they expect to see, what they wish they would see, that they know they won't see, and just generally speaking, what they think the impact of all this is going to be on the decision-making process that we're all going through right now. How many of you guys are early voting? Anybody out there gonna try to grab your ballot early? I think that they're ready. I think, as I recall, our Secretary of State said they were ready, was it last Friday afternoon or something like that, Tom? Do you
exactly,
remember?
On Friday, Secretary of State Jim Condos. You can go, the best thing, you can go to is the website, but just go to your town clerk.
Mm.
And some of the town clerks actually had them earlier than that, but now you can
actually pick one up and
yeah.
do it. And I guess the thing that determines that is how soon they have to mail them out to military personnel overseas in order to get them back by Election Day. Is that correct?
Well, I know one thing that's just interesting is the rise of how many people are doing. And there's not as many restrictions as there used to be, and there's just more of an increase in folks voting that way. So, and he has been on before talking about trying to keep things secure. Worried about cyber attacks and stuff.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I think Vermont has a huge advantage is we still have hard copies of everybody's ballot. Even folks who use optical scanners to count these ballots, there's still a piece of paper for everybody, and that gives me an awful lot more confidence. I think another interesting thing that's going to come out of this early voting is we're going to have an idea of who made up their mind early. You know, if we see a kind of a giant swell in the proportion of voters who do vote early, we'll know that decisions were made early. If it's not so high, we can perhaps infer that folks are really taking it right down to the wire. I think it's going to be an interesting thing to look at that as well. Anyway, what do you think? Give us a call, 244-1777, or toll free, 1-877-291-8255. You look like you were about to do something.
Yeah, well, I was trying to take a call, but I had a lot of people on cell phones, and I'm not trying to keep them off, but our system, if it breaks up, just drops them.
Ugh, that's really frustrating. I know it. Yeah, guys, I don't know what to tell you. We're sorry. We're not intentionally cutting you off. We really are not. The problem is that we have a technical system that's fussy about what it likes to establish a connection with, and that's partly to benefit our listeners so that they can hear nice, clear signals and so that your idea can come through in your own words without being dropped or broken up or spoiled by some kind of technical glitch. Try again if you would. 244-1777 or toll-free 1-877-291-8255. We're going to cut away to news at the top of the hour, and then we look forward to chatting with Victoria Jones or whoever her stand-in might be today. Actually, I'm pretty sure it's going to be Victoria from Talk Media News. She calls in every Monday morning from the basement of the White House. What a picture I have when I think of when she tells us that, with her back to the frost wall, you know, her knees up under her chin. Gracious. Love to hear what she's thinking about today's big events in Long Island and what the buzz is around the nation's capital about these things. Who's paying attention? What specifically are they paying attention to? And we'll just have to see. Tom, we had a really interesting point made. Actually, it's been made by several listeners that they're not looking at this as a win-lose kind of thing. They're really looking at it as an opportunity to get some information. But, of course, the pundits are all going to spin it that way. And, you know, one of the headlines we're all going to be slammed into tomorrow is going to be who, quote-unquote, won this debate. I wonder why. Is that just a media appetite for winners and losers that makes that happen? Is it just it's easier to tell a story about a winner or a loser as opposed to here's some interesting things that emerged in the conversation last night?
Hard to say, because it just depends on the person. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, some people see things as win and lose. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's how, because of sports being so popular.
Ratings battles.
Yeah, and there's the media component. But, you know, some people do look at it as win and lose. Other people look at it, well, just want to hear what they have to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm curious. I'm wondering if I'll hear anything new, I guess. I'm not sure I will. I think it will be interesting to monitor the Twitter sphere, the Twitter universe tonight. I'm not a big Twitterer.
No, I'm not. I have no interest in that. But it's very interesting taking over.
Yep, it is. It's kind of interesting to see people's kind of right off the cuff reactions to some of these things boil down to 145 characters. Be interesting to monitor that. It'll also be interesting to look at some of the live reporting blogs that take this on and express different points of view. I'm betting that going to look at some of the third-party websites, there are doubtless going to be live blogging activities going on there, so we will be able to get a take on alternative points of view.
Well, so many from listening to it here on WDEV tonight at 9, you can listen to the radio, you can watch it, you can stream it. I mean, there is a lot of ways to get the information. Pretty amazing times we live in.
It is pretty amazing, and I hope it ends up being for the better. Sometimes I wonder about all this stuff slamming into us and why we can't just kind of go back to, we can't go back, I know that, but I wonder if it was healthier when we could listen to one channel on the radio and go out and make up our own minds while we split wood or did something else out in the out in the field.
Well, as they say, 85 years WDEV News Radio celebrating the future.
There we go. And here we are. Oh, this is a good time to remind folks that if you heard something this morning that you would like to hear again or that you would like to share with somebody, you can always find Open Mic as a podcast on the RadioVermont.com website. Look for the banner for Open Mic and follow it to the archive, and you'll see stuff in there by date. We are Monday, and Monday is today's date. Jay Austin, who's our web guy, is just really, really on the ball. So I'm guessing that he will be able to have that up for us pretty quick, and you can tune in and share if you would like to. Right now, though, we want to remind you that you are listening to News Radio, WDEV News Radio at 96.1 FM, broadcasting from the top of Sugar Bush. Also, 96.5 out of Barrie, over the independently owned airwaves at 101.9 in Island Pond, and now clear as Crystal Bell on 98.3 FM in Montpelier. And, of course, broadcasting from the Nifty 550 AM, the flagship station, WDEV, Waterbury, Montpelier. We'll be back on the other side of the news. Ooh, a little Zydeco. I like that. Good morning and welcome back to Open Mic here on WDEV. No, that's not Zydeco. That's Pop. Robin Zydeco. Oh, well. Anyway, Hester Fuller is my name. I'm with you for another hour here on WDEV's Open Mic program at 11, of course. Common Sense Radio takes over. I like the idea that we're not Common Sense Radio, and they come on after me. I like that. Governor Shumlin has asked his department leaders to see if any of their programs could be eliminated in order to help balance the state budget. Not just cut back, outright eliminated in order to live within our means. If you were a department leader, what program would you eliminate? Rob Roper and Bill Sayre want to know your thoughts, and so you should plan to call in during Common Sense Radio this morning at 11 o'clock on WDEV, brought to you by the Ethan Allen Institute, 11 to 12 every weekday here on WDEV. Right now, though, we're going to zip down to Washington, D.C., where Victoria Jones is speaking to us. Are you in the basement of the White House again?
I am, indeed.
you have to know the image that I have in my head every time you tell me that. It's great. What's up? Are people paying attention to the debate down there? I imagine they are.
Absolutely. We're expecting nearly 100 million people to be paying attention to the debate.
Mm-hmm. What's the buzz about it?
The buzz about it is that they both have things that they have to do tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's not necessarily the only debate that matters, because there are, after all, three debates.
Mm-hmm.
And so we shouldn't get all excited about, oh, it's the debate. It's not the debate. There's three of them. And if there'd only been one debate, you know, before, then President Obama would not be the president, because he effectively lost the first debate to Mitt Romney.
That's a point well taken. When you say they have things to do, things to accomplish, what I've been hearing sounds like one of the things that a lot their handlers are doing are trying to manage expectations pretty heavily.
They are trying to manage expectations. They're trying to, obviously, the Trump people are trying to talk down Trump to a certain extent. They want to, you know, on the one hand, you've got Kellyanne Conway saying that he's the Babe Ruth of debaters, but they're also trying to say that he's the outsider, so they're doing it from both sides.
Mm-hmm.
But then they're also saying that anytime you're debating a Clinton, you're dealing with veracity, so that they're saying that at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And the Clinton people are basically just saying that Trump is going to be lying. So they're saying that. But they're acknowledging that she has to say what she's about. And then the debate watchers are saying that Trump has to be careful not to insult Clinton, and that she has to be careful to mask her contempt for him.
Mm. To mask her contempt for him?
Yes.
For fear of alienating the people who are diehard Trump supporters?
Not only them, but also people don't like to see people who are contemptuous or snarky.
And I would imagine that goes double for women.
Exactly. It does go double for women, and women don't like to see it either.
No, I think, I don't particularly care to see people be nasty to each other in any context. What do you think Trump's strong suit, if there is one, is going to be tonight? Not to betray my bias.
He is a showman.
Mm-hmm.
And he has experience with reality TV.
Mm-hmm.
And even though she's the more experienced debater, mm-hmm. he probably has finer TV instincts than she does.
Mm.
I think that's probably his advantage.
Well, now, she was at pains to point out this weekend, and I've heard her say repeatedly, this isn't reality TV, it's actual reality.
The presidency is reality, but the debate is reality TV, too.
That's
it's
a really
reality
good point.
And reality TV.
Very interesting point, and I think you're probably right about that. We're going to have to see. Apart from the newsies and the journalistic crowd and the government crowd, do you have a sense of what the man in the street is thinking about this, or the woman on the street is thinking about all this? Are they going about?
I'm thinking about this as a person on
sure.
the street, because I'm watching this because I have to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not what I want to watch tonight. I'll tell you.
Mm.
So that's how I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking, am I going to be bored by 90 minutes with no breaks? And I'm also thinking, you know, what am I going to learn that's new about them?
Mm-hmm.
That's something I'm going to learn. And am I going to learn anything about any policy? And I'm also wondering, how am I going to be able to tell the truth from a lie?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have that concern. And for that reason, I think a lot of people are also going to be monitoring digital social media streams, blogs, and so forth. Is that part of your plan for watching these kinds of events?
Yes, because now apparently Lester Holt is, according to people close to him, is not going to be a potted plant or a lamppost. Now, mm-hmm. we don't know what that means exactly,
mm-hmm.
because we don't know what kind of calling out he's going to do, if any, but he's not planning to be he's not going to be a potted plant. So we don't know what that means.
Well, we'll just have to wait and see, and it sounds like it's going to be yet another chapter in this ongoing crazy saga that has been our election season in 2016.
Yep.
Thank you, Victoria, and we will be touching base a week from now and maybe Monday morning quarterbacking way back then.
Indeed. Thank
Indeed.
You.
Thank you very much for calling. Victoria Jones from Talk Media News, who joins us every Monday morning at this time to give us the scoop from the basement of the White House. Here we are at about quarter after 10, and we need to pause for commercial break. Good morning and welcome back. This is Open Mic on WDEV News Radio, broadcasting out of Waterbury, also from Warren Berry Island Pond, and now from Montpelier, too. Glad to have you along this morning. We've been talking about the debates that are on tap for this evening, and we've been interested in your points of view on the current contest. 244-1777 or toll free. Excuse me, 1-877-291-8255. We're going to change gears in just a little while, though. Talk about development here in Vermont that a number of people are sad about. We lost David Budbill over the weekend. The poet passed away after battling Parkinson's disease for quite some time. We're going to be taking some time to reflect on his life and his work, and we will do that in just a bit as soon as our special guest arrives. Right now, though, we're going to dip down to Williamstown, Vermont, where Rama's on the line. Good morning, Rama.
Good morning. Gosh, so I got to lead into what you're going to come up with next. So I apologize for the crassness of this call.
Well, go right ahead.
Well, let me start off with, because I can still say it, go Cubbies.
So oh, right, yes.
That aside. One of my favorite presidential, I'll put presidential in quote, but presidential debate moments was Al Gore strutting over towards W. Bush with his chest out and his shoulders straight, looking like he was going to give Bush a roundhouse to the jaw. You remember that one?
I don't, but I'm
really?
Perfectly happy to entertain your vision in my mind's eye.
That's literally what it was. I mean, I exaggerate not. They were at their podium, spaced well apart, and George W. Bush is answering some question. I have no idea what the content of the debate was about. But as Al Gore just goes, struts over directly towards George W. Bush, his shoulders held straight up and straight out, his chest puffed out, arms down by his side, kind of a little bit akimbo, looking like he's about to come up with a roundhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes about halfway across and then turns around and comes back.
Comes straight back. Okay. Yep, yep. Robo Gore.
Yeah, and even Barbara Bush there, George's mom, of course, she said she was worried that Al Gore was going to clock him.
Well.
And it did. It gave that appearance until Gore turned around and went back to his podium.
You know, isn't it funny that that's what we recall about some of these days gone by, the theater of it all?
Well, because a lot of what they say, they've already said, and they're going to just be repeating. And listen, I understand, having run for office, I understand the concept of a stump speech and why it's so important, because you don't want to keep changing what you're saying to different people. You want to convey the same message. Mm-hmm. It's rational. It makes sense. Having said that, though, I think the format for the debate should be no audience,
You're
no
not
moderator, a locked room. They can only come out when the debate's over.
Rubber walls.
And, well, no, let's let them really go at it if they want. I mean, if Al Gore had really wanted to go over and give George W. Bush a roundhouse, it should have been for us to decide who's the more manly of the two. And
well,
that's not the reason to vote for somebody.
Call me strange, but that's not the basis on which I'm going to pick the next leader of the free world. You
well,
know?
They were pushing George W. Bush as the guy you wanted to have a beer with.
No, that was Gerald Ford. Oh, no, was a cookout.
That was the guy you wanted to have. So come on now. If they can push all these other ridiculous assertions and you listen to Don, the narcissistic bully wannabe Trump out there, is apparently you can just make stuff up and accuse people of and tell lies straight and through. Listen, the truth is, if they want to have a debate, no outside interference. Put them in a room. You give them each a microphone, just like in chess matches where while you're trying to make your move, you have a clock ticking, and you have a total amount of time that you can use up. If you use up your time, you're done.
You're done.
You lose. And they should just run the debates. No moderators.
Well, you know, I don't know how that would differ from the day to day. I think with a moderator, at least you have a prayer of sort of bending the conversation into areas that people are genuinely interested in.
Well, we bend it to where the moderator's interested, for sure. I mean, Matt Lauer with his pushing Hillary Clinton about the emails for 15 minutes at a foreign policy forum.
Good point.
You know, so but there's no such thing as an unbiased media.
Right.
Doesn't exist. Never has, never will. Don't expect it. And if you really want to see how people are going to talk and answer and be able to respond to what's thrown out there, you put them face-to-face. You say, okay, you guys go at it. We're going to film it. We're going to cut off your microphone after you've talked for X amount of minutes. And that's it. Have fun, guys.
Duly noted. Rama, thank you very much for that perspective. We have another call waiting, so I'm going to have to let you go. But you know I always love it when you call me on Monday, so please do again. Betty from Northfield, good morning to you.
Good morning. Points I want to point out.
Okay.
Number one, top of the list, is if my husband was a bank robber or my wife was a prostitute, would I be held liable for their behavior like you're holding Hillary liable for Bill's doings?
You know, I've been wondering something very similar.
You know, women have been free to have their own mind for a good number of years now. Another point is that truth and reality are two different things. And I keep hearing, oh, this one is whatever they say is true. She has a grip on the truth. He has a grip, doesn't have a grip on reality. They're two different things.
Help me understand the distinction you see. In what way is truth not reality and vice versa?
Well, the truth is, reality is what is real in this world. And in a lot of people's minds, truth is whatever I believe. I believe it, so that makes it true because I'm the one that's making the decision.
So truth is relative and reality isn't? Is that the distinction?
And it's very, I'm very curious. Also, with regard to fact-checking, I think it would be the most marvelous thing because in our day of the Internet and everything and swipe and Twitter and tweet and all that, everybody is being spoon-fed. And I go on my computer about every other day now because I get sick of seeing it. But everybody's out there trying to skew your opinion one way or another, and why can't we just have a good, positive election where people don't have to degrade each other,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, the rest of the world is looking at us like a bunch of buffoons right now.
Mm-hmm.
We can't put forth a good candidate. We can't seem to get off our tweeters and Twitters long enough to really, really think before we do things.
Mm-hmm.
We seem to be a very act now,
think later,
act in haste, repent at leisure.
Yeah, I hear you.
And I'm just wondering, those points, you know, people need to make their own decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Think a little bit, you know. If you're talking to a carpenter, he'll tell you, he will cut once, but measure twice.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's first. A good plan. Always a good plan. Let me just quickly ask you one little thing. It goes back to the very beginning of what you were talking about. You began to speak about us all being spoon-fed in this digital media age.
We are.
Yeah. Do you feel like there's not the same? We used to enjoy some pretty responsible gatekeepers on our information. I'm thinking of people like Edward R. Murrow, and there aren't any now.
No,
so
you can say what you can go onto the internet, say whatever you want. You can call your neighbor a butcher and a liar, and that's out there forever.
Mm-hmm.
People don't think. I worked for an office of the state in the state government
mm-hmm.
for almost 30 years. I'm 70 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they told us when they first brought the computers online, because I had to help with doing that, and one of the things that we were told over and over again, don't put anything out there that you wouldn't want your mother to hear or see.
That's what I used to tell my students. Don't put anything on the internet you wouldn't want to see running around that news ticker, and, you know, in the middle of the New Year's Eve celebrations in Times
yes.
Square. Yeah,
that's
I hear you.
Exactly. But
I hear you.
You know, that's my opinion.
Yep.
And we all have one.
And that's why I have this program, and I'm very grateful that you called us in to called in to share with us your opinion, Betty, and I hope you'll do it again. Right now, we got to jump up to Burlington, where Butch is on the line waiting for his turn. Hi, Butch. What are you thinking about?
Hey, good morning. I'm wondering if, and maybe I missed it here in traveling around this morning on the radio, but are Johnson and Weld going to be able to participate in the election on the main stage at some point with Clinton and Trump?
I don't believe so. I believe that was a topic that we took up this morning. My understanding is no, that neither one of them cleared the threshold of percentage of votes during the primary season to make it onto the main stage. So my understanding is no.
So they won't be allowed in the election. They can participate, I suppose, any
oh,
other
they're in
way
the
they
election.
Afford,
they're in the election. They're just not in the debates.
Right. That's what I meant to say.
Yeah.
But so other than that, it's ads or however they can get their name out there, right?
I would imagine. I think a lot of them are using digital media to help spread
right.
the word. It's been such an effective tool.
Thank you.
Okay, Butch, thanks for calling. Nancy from Randolph, you're on the air on open mic.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. In thinking back to former debates, I remember reading in the magazine Extra about when Bush was, I believe it was when he was running for re-election, and he had something in his ear that gave him directions with a cord going down the back of his jacket.
Uh-huh.
And no one was allowed to take pictures of him from the rear.
Oh, goodness.
But someone did.
Yeah.
So I didn't actually see that debate, but the source was reputable, I felt, along with the story. And so that just shows you, I think, how those debates should be carefully
monitored.
Yes.
Yeah, I hear you. Nancy, thanks for that little tidbit. I will be carrying that around in my head for the entire day. You are listening to Open Mic, and my name is Hester Fuller. I'm with you until 11 o'clock this morning. We're going to take a brief break for some commercial business, and then we're going to change topics and spend some time talking about a beloved Vermonter, a wonderful poet who has left us. David Budbill passed away on Sunday, and I will be joined by my special guest, Rusty DeWeese, and we'll be chatting about David right after these words. Good morning and welcome back to Open Mic on WDEV. Hester Fuller is my name, and I'll be with you until 11 o'clock. Very happy to welcome possibly my favorite guest. Rusty Deweese is with us. Good morning, Rusty.
Hey, Hester. How
Glad you're in here today.
How's Craftsbury?
Craftsbury rocks. You know,
yeah, just, I know it does.
It's
I know
an awesome spot.
Yep.
I'm very happy and proud to be a citizen
yep.
of that little town. We're actually here today on not such a happy day. We have lost someone that I think is tremendous, and I know you had a very special friendship with him as well. David Budbill left us yesterday.
Yeah. What was it? 12:30
something
a.m. Sunday morning, I guess.
I think so. Yeah,
that's it was a little bit after midnight.
It was in this morning's Times Argus. I printed out here. We could take.
Oh yeah, that's where.
Yeah, for those of us who, for those of you who didn't know this, he David Budbill died early Sunday morning from complications of the Parkinson's disease that had slowed him up. Something wicked. He died at 12:30 in the morning on Sunday. His friend Susan Walp sent out an email at about 7 o'clock about a vigil that would be held last evening at their home. I guess, Rusty, you were there.
I did, yeah.
Then Lois and Nadine, his wife and daughter, sent out an email on Saturday afternoon explaining that he'd been diagnosed with progressive supranuclear palsy about a year ago, and that 2 weeks ago he was diagnosed with an ailment that is actually a common complication for those who are suffering from that condition. And he went downhill pretty quick, and then we lost him.
He did. He did. What a guy, though.
What a guy, indeed. Now, I know you were friends with him for a long time, and that he had a pretty important impact on the things that you do now.
I think 1985.
Really? Before we go there, I want to ask you, when you think about him, when you hear the news, what are you seeing in your mind's eye? What do you see? What do you remember? What do you see?
Well, there is a process here, personally, because in June, the family called on friends to go over and sit with David while Lois could go out and do some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They're in a condo over in Montpelier there.
Yeah, he had to move out of Wilcott, which broke his heart.
Well, that was they were the real deal.
Yeah.
Well, that's one thing that comes into my mind. Lois and David, it's kind of fun. I don't really think too much of David alone, one singular, as I always think of Lois. But because they were the real deal, like Scott and Helen Nearingy, as we're going to get.
Oh, that's
for my money, you know what I mean? They moved up here and they built their own house up in Wolcott, and they did the gardens and the wood, and they weren't kidding. Mm-hmm. It wasn't an affect.
No, not a bit.
So anyway, in June I was able to sit with him and hang with him and watch him for 3-4 hours, a kind of mythical man in my mind. And so if you're writing your life story, you get this moment with this man that was very important to many, and the earth and the universe. And I got to sit there. Didn't know that'd be the last time I'd sit with him. Of course it wasn't, because I sat with him yesterday.
Oh, good.
At the vigil. Yeah. So, but anyway, we chat. I found out some things about him. And then, you know.
Anything you can share?
Well, I like to smoke a cigar every now and then.
Well,
and that's come late, right? And you like the smell of them.
Yeah,
was it grandfather? That was your grandfather?
No, my dad, my brother.
Oh, the whole crew.
Nobody smokes, but everybody likes cigars. So.
Well, I was sitting there in June when I was telling David, because I was always a clean. And he was, oh, yeah? And I like cigars. Cigar? He says, I said, yeah. I said, you ever smoke? Because I didn't know that he ever, I knew him since 85. He said, I smoked everything. So I guess he smoked like when he was young, writing in New York City, the cigarettes and the little cigars. And he told me some great stories about that. Anyway, that's just one thing.
Now, pretty early in your career, when you got back from New York, I guess, he tapped you for a performance in a work that he was doing.
Talk about
Judevine?
Actually, no, that was before I went to
New York. Oh, it was before you went to New York.
So I went to New York. I was 29. That was 89. No, 80. I got out of college. And then there was Vermont Repertory Theater
was a group out there.
And then another guy in my life was Robert Ringer, who was the founder and artistic director of Vermont Repertory Theater. I had done Buried Child with them, Sam Shepard play. With Robert Ringer. And that was a great thing. But anyway, he says to me, I was going to go to work at UPS. And he said, you know, I'm doing the Vermont Repertory Theater is going to do a play of an original play every year, and I'm going to do this thing by this Vermont poet named David Budbill, and it's called Judevine, and he said you should be in this, and I was literally going to go on to my life's career as a UPS driver. And long story short, I did decide to try out for that, and Judevine, and meeting David Budbill, that was I think 1985.
changed a lot of
things. Changed my life, but the Jew Divine changed many people's lives, and it will continue to. And I'm sitting in front of the book right here.
Yeah, I think so. I think so indeed. And one of the things about that particular play, that particular book of his work, you had something in common with David when it comes to portraying. You, of course, went on to develop The Logger, which you are still developing from what I can tell.
Right.
And he's aging, and we're aging right along with him, and it's kind of fun to see that. Both of you, though, are kind of non-natives, right? You come from Philly originally, grew up in Stowe, kind of. David was from Cleveland, I guess. And I know that was sort of an issue. He wrote about it, actually. It was in a couple of his poems. Did you ever really talk about that, the business of being not native, and what it makes you notice about being here in a particular way?
No, because first of all, you know, I moved here when I was 7 with my folks, but no, and I'm not native. I was never hung up on that.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons is because if all of you folks, and I don't want to, you know, bring levity to trying to be funny, but all of you folks out there, you have to go buy something of David Budbill's very, very soon, because you will be very happy you did. But in Jew Divine, the opening thing, but I think, so I don't know who says it. Maybe it's just the company. But who's native? The rocks, the soil, the earth, the tree, the dirt. And that wasn't an excuse. Oh, you're going to read that?
No.
That wasn't an excuse that David Budbill was making. Mm-hmm. I don't believe. I never thought. So we never talked about that. But when I was a young guy, I was 25 in 1985, and I heard that. And well, that made sense, not to someone who isn't a Vermonter, but it made sense, like I would say, much of the things I've read that David wrote to the world, to the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he wrote.
We're all water passing through.
Right. That was another line. Yeah. So, and it's kind of, for me, he wrote, and recently a lot of his writing was about, well, all writing is about life and death, I guess, but about the peace and the life and the death. And now it's almost kind of odd that he is there.
It's like he almost sort of faded to black, and he's still kind of with us.
Yeah.
You, of course, were known for Antoine, and I wonder, you brought Jew Divine with you. Could you treat us to a little bit?
No, I don't know if I can. I don't know. Antoine's a French-Canadian guy,
did you want?
I was reading through this, and here's the thing, listeners, all seriousness, because I did Antoine. Many people, gosh darn it, a good friend of mine played it when Lost Nation did it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't get his name. Oh my God! Anyway, a lot of people played Antoine, and Antoine is like the uncle of the town, and a French Canadian guy, and a little short guy, and I was tall. But anyway, he swears a lot, and I don't. And I was reading through this morning when you kindly asked me to come on the show, and I said I don't think I want to read Antoine because I wouldn't want to, hide the swears. Who wants to hear your work cut like that?
No, I agree with that.
But what about, could I read Hermie?
You can read Hermie if you want to.
So, yeah. So here's folks out there who don't know anything about David Budbill. Here's Hermie. Hermie Newcomb lived in a bread truck on the edge of Bear Swamp. The bread truck is still there with a spruce tree through the roof and the remains of his last pig pen. He had a bunk up front where the seats used to be so in the morning he could wake up and look out the windshield at the day. There was a little wood stove in the back. Hermie brought the stove wood in through the rear door so he wouldn't have to lug it through his bedroom. There was a table and chair and some crates for cupboards. It was always neat in there. It was a good place and cozy. Hermie didn't need anything big as a bus. His woman, Florence, was an Indian from New York. Before he lived in the bread truck, they had a shack next to the Dunhill Cemetery, and before that, they lived on Hermie's family place on the Aiken Pond Road up from the schoolhouse where I used to live. But one night, while they were still at the home place, Hermie got pissed at something, nobody knows what, and flew into a rage, which he did about twice a week. But this time, went too far and lit both house and barn and watched them burn. When the neighbors came, Hermie was out in the snow, in the dooryard, stomping and screaming. Burn, gold dang it. Burn, you worthless place. You never was no gold dang good. Nobody could ever be quite sure when Hermie was drunk. He acted crazy all the time. There's nothing left of the Newsome place now, only the spring box. Those tamarack boards will last forever. Well, then they moved over to the shack by the cemetery. Hermie liked it there, said it was the first place he ever lived, where he had decent neighbors. Antoine tells about going past there on a Saturday night and seeing Hermie and Florence dancing with the chainsaw going in the middle of the floor. Hermie and Florence would get drunk, then Hermie would adjust the carburetor on the saw so it would run too rich, so it would sputter, bounce with a rhythm worthy of a good musician. And then they'd sing and dance to the music of the saw. Mm-hmm. Hermie could cut pulp like a son of a gun. You know, he could bull and jam when he wanted to, but that wasn't very often. Everybody said he was worthless. Hiram still says his mother should have knocked him in the head when he was born and spent the money on some grain to raise a pig. Well, Hermie never did anybody any harm. In fact, the night he burnt the home place, he was sure to get Florence and the cats out before he struck the match. He burnt the cemetery place, too. That's when Florence left him, went back to the reservation or to Morrisville, I don't know where. Then he moved alone into the bread truck in the swamp. Hermie spent his life looking for the perfect place. That's what all those fires were about. And in the end, he found that place. The bread truck wouldn't burn.
Mm. Wonderful.
Yeah, doesn't
Rusty DeWeese,
every
my,
time get you?
I know. My guest, reading David Bubbill's Hermie. You know, there's a story that I've known all the time I've lived in Vermont, and it's maybe not true. I don't know if it's true or not, that shortly after, maybe it was Judevine, came out, he went to supper in Wolcott Town Hall. And got his plate, saw some neighbors, went over, sat down there, was sitting there for about 3 minutes, and everybody got up and left the table. And he didn't know what that was about, so he finished his chicken pie and went over and picked up some shortcake and went back, found another table, sat down. Everybody got up and left. And he didn't know what the story was. Come to find out afterwards, he was talking with some friends out on the street after the supper, saying they don't want to wind up in your next book.
I believe that, and I've heard something similar to that. Also, I think when he and Lois were here in, I think right off in 70 or maybe 69. Mm-hmm. And he was writing this stuff, and it wasn't, you know, media wasn't what it is today, and people didn't want to be in a book. And I think maybe some folks thought that he was making fun of them, maybe, you know, and then there's some race stuff in there. Mm-hmm. So when David Budd, it's beautiful, and we can read it now, and most people will be very innocent-minded about it, but I think back when he wrote it, it was kind of,
yeah.
Brave.
Yeah, it was very brave, especially in a place like this where everybody knows you. And when your life turns and you're an out-of-towner. Yeah, even if you are just water passing through, you're not local water for a long time.
Right.
That's really a good point,
bringing that up, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. His interests ranged far and wide, and some of the stuff I really loved that he did were poems that either drew upon or reflected upon or kind of engaged in a conversation with some of the ancient Chinese poets.
Yes.
Love that stuff. Did you ever talk to him about that and the importance that had for him?
No, I didn't talk to him about that so much. I do love all that recent work. Mm-hmm. I call it recent work from his stuff. But he lived it he was quiet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he and Lois lived up there in Wolcott. They're quiet souls, but he wasn't really quiet. But you know what I mean by living life quite simple. He was always like many folks and looking for the calmness. It's all in the words that he's written and the simplicity. So we didn't really talk about that, but it was evident in the way he carried himself that I got it. I didn't have to ask any questions.
No, and you could see that. And it's a walking, talking, not talking example. At the same time, he struggled with the ambition that a lot of people who are in the arts struggle with. And that was
openly.
Yeah, he had a couple. In fact, I was just digging it up here. He had a couple of poems that he wrote. And now, of course, after all this trouble, I can't put my hand on it. Here we go. Here's one that he wrote. Dilemma. I want to be famous so I can be humble about being famous. What good is my humility when I'm stuck in this obscurity? The honesty with which he dealt with and acknowledged that, you know, even though he had chosen this place to live because you can make work here. You can make work.
And he certainly did make work.
But it also kind of chewed on him a little bit, I think, that there was the trade-off.
Yeah, like I say, he wrote about it a lot in his recent stuff. And when I started, and we were doing Judevine, he would come to most every rehearsal from Wolcott. And
really?
The theater was in Winooski. And,
wow.
And here I am, a young guy, kind of aspiring, but I didn't know I was aspiring yet.
Mm-hmm.
And here's this, I thought he was a heavyweight guy. Now, this is a guy that had his poems in real magazines and stuff, you know what I mean? Like big ones.
Yeah.
And here he was, just a regular guy, and he was very open, and he would rewrite and bring it back the next day. And, of course, we became friends. But to be able to be a youngster in a play where the writer is there and very open to what we would offer and add, that's what that I took a guy that was got D's and F's in school, maybe a couple C's, and it made me understand that, well, these writer guys that I am intimidated by in schoolwork, mm-hmm. they're just David Budbill. Like, you can be just a, you can be not just, you can be a David Budbill. He's mm-hmm. he's a writer.
He's a regular guy.
And
how
also,
could he be a
of course, and also he did use the common language. Yes. We'll call it common language. And I was, as an entertainer now, as a aspire, I was able to see that people were attracted to that. Mm-hmm. You know, where back then that was, you know, so, oh, mm-hmm. we don't, shouldn't swear. We're still can't swear on this thing. You know what I mean? So people are attracted to realness. So mm-hmm. there's a lot. There's a lot. And also music,
mm-hmm.
the rhythm of the way he wrote it was mm-hmm. all about music for him, man. And he
tell us more about that.
Well, he would blow his sax. He would bring his sax, you know, to a rehearsal, and you'd get there early, and he'd be blowing the sax in the corner. And a lot of what he did, I think this is what I recall. You know, the last 20 years, he would play with, was it William Parker? A jazz musician.
Yeah.
I'd hate if I got
and wasn't
that
there,
name
there
wrong.
Was somebody else? Did he do something with Dan Lindner?
Could be, but he played the, I don't know what you call it, but probably yeah. the recorder yeah. and the sax.
Yes,
and,
but also.
But it's the rhythm of the words. Yes. Forget it. Forget yeah. the reed instrument.
Right.
He would always have feeling, and he would talk about it
mm-hmm.
openly.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved that. Mm-hmm. And he loved delicacy and movement on stage. He wasn't kidding, man. You know,
well, he always complimented you for your timing, both for comedy and other kinds of emotions. Did working with his words help you kind of hone that?
So I had done musicals as a kid, and then I went to, and then I did the Sam Shepard
mm-hmm.
drama, the serious stuff. And then I get to be in Judavine with Vermont Rep with David Budbill. I remember the script on my bed as I'm practicing it, reading this stuff, and it was coming as easy as air into your lungs, mm-hmm. man, because of it was just so easy,
mm-hmm.
you know, his work. And I don't think it's any different for anyone else. I'm not saying that's unique to me. When we were touring it, we toured it like three times and then a fourth time with a different theater company. And I would, the first time we did it, it was a big thing. Back then, if something hit in Burlington, mm-hmm. there wasn't anything else going on. You remember Man with a Plan? Mm-hmm. It had mm-hmm. legs for yeah. 6, 7, 8 months.
Right.
Judavine hit out there. And that mm-hmm. was when Paula Routley and they were all writing for, and Pamela were writing for Vermont Times and all, and Peter Framers, and you were out there. But so it hit. Now, where was my mind going?
You were talking about the way his words just, I mean, he heard real people and real people spoke through.
Right, I lost my thought on how it hit. But anyway.
Well, in addition to that skill with the language and the ability to make it, I mean, carefully crafted, but to feel just like it just was, like you said, is like taking air into your own lungs. It's just right. amazing. He was also very sort of disciplined about, and he has a little poem that I actually have this tacked up over my desk
oh,
at
great.
Home. Because it, for me, it's watchwords, too. He called it the three goals. The first goal is to see the thing in itself, in and for itself, to see it simply and clearly for what it is. No symbolism, please. The second goal is to see each individual thing as unified, as one with all the other 10,000 things. In this regard, a little wine helps a lot. The third goal is to grasp the first and the second goals, to see the universal in the particular simultaneously. Regarding this one, call me when you get it.
Yes, he always brings it around.
Yeah, he does. I love that about him. I loved his work. I never met him. I kind of didn't want to meet him. You know,
oh,
I kind of avoided meeting
yeah.
him because the work in my mind is just, it means an awful lot to me, and it does a lot for me, and I like having that there.
Yeah.
But I do feel a tremendous loss that we won't see more of that.
Yeah, I mean, but again, anybody out there that has never read anything of David's, I would definitely run right to a bookstore. I'm not just saying that.
No, of course.
Because I feel that if you read it, it's like good nutrition.
Yeah. Absolutely. I would totally agree with that.
Good food and health and exercise.
Yep, yep, yep. Yeah. Getting simple and getting precise and getting clear. And
hard to do that, too. That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a gentle man, but a strong, rough guy.
Mm-hmm.
But when, you know, because you write, to make those simple little three-line poems or whatever you want to call them,
mm-hmm.
that's tough. Mm-hmm. Anybody can go up there and blabber for 20 minutes.
Well, that's
and
what Mark Twain used to say that, too. I would have written you a shorter letter, but I didn't have time. I mean,
right.
Everything down.
So that's another thing about David. You don't have to, if you buy one of David's books and read, you don't have to spend an afternoon trying to understand what this poetry is.
That's right.
It's like, bam. Oh, I get that. And again, it was, so yeah, what I was saying is, back to what I was saying, when I learned this stuff, it came like anything. And we were touring the first tour, and we were all young little actors, and it was a phenomenon, you know, relatively speaking. And I said that we were all sitting outside in the sun before, in the afternoon before a show, and I said, we may never have an experience like this again. Mm-hmm. That was one thing I said, and I was right. Mm-hmm. I don't know about the other folks. They may have. That was number one. The other thing I said kind of myths some actors, pardon me, and some directors. I say, you're in Judah Vine. It was a great production, great work. You know, we did great. We did all these productions, and Robert Ringer was a brilliant director. But it's unscrew-upable. If you sit down and read Judah Vine, read the script, it could be four people who have never done any acting. If you read it, the people listening to it are going to be blown away.
I think so. If you read actors can't kill it. If you listen to it while you read it. I mean, a lot of people just kind of rattle through.
Right. But if all you have to do is it's unscrew-upable.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Rusty DeWeese is my guest right now. We've been talking about David Budbill, who passed away yesterday. We need to take a bit of a break, and we'll be back right here on Open Mic. Good morning, and welcome back to Open Mic on WDEV. Hester Fuller is my name, sitting here with Rusty DeWeese, remembering David Budbill this morning. He passed away over the weekend. Love to hear from you if you were a fan of his work. If you have a story to share, give us a call at 244-1777 or toll-free 1-877-291-8255. Talking this morning about David Budbill. I pulled one of the Chinese poet poems out this morning, which I really, really enjoyed, called Bugs in a Bowl.
Yeah.
You know that one?
No.
Han Shan, that great and crazy, wonder-filled Chinese poet of 1,000 years ago, said, "We're just like bugs in a bowl, all day, going around, never leaving their bowl." I say that's right. Every day, climbing up the steep sides and sliding back over and over again, around and around, up and back down. Sit in the bottom of the bowl, head in your hands. Cry, moan, feel sorry for yourself. Or look around. See your fellow bugs. Walk around. Say, "Hey, how you doing?" Say, "Nice bowl."
Yeah. Well, yeah.
But I see what you mean about just, it feels like air. His work is kind of unscrew-upable.
I think what you just read is, you know, a lot of people don't like poets. And stuff like reading.
They wouldn't think that was, but it is.
Yeah. So if they read that, they'd go, "Ooh, that's kind of nice." Mm-hmm. But again, the basic thing, David Budbill was a very, very close friend of mine, but just a generous man to so many. Mm-hmm. You know, that if you're hearing my words about working with him, there's thousands out there.
Yeah.
And somebody said that, I shouldn't say this, but somebody said that they had an event for him. About a month ago or something, the Lost Nation.
That wasn't at the event in June? You were there.
Was it June? Yeah, I was in it, yeah, but I forget when it was. Yeah, but anyway.
It was last summer. It was for his birthday, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And he was able to be there. It's kind of like being able to be there at your own funeral when people are celebrating you.
Absolutely. But who knew how long he would last. But anyway, somebody said, "Yeah, you know, it's a sin or shame or something that you never won the big poet laureate thing or something," or whatever that is.
Yeah.
Of course, me, I'm sitting there thinking, "Well, that's exactly right." Good. Exactly. That makes sense.
Yeah.
He's who he is. He's great.
Mm-hmm. And it's not that he went without recognition. I mean, he went to Google.
Oh, of course. Of course. Who cares about these things?
That's right.
You know,
well, he did a little bit.
But he could get in touch with that part of it that was. Mm-hmm. So he examined all of that.
Yeah.
And that's which is what writing is and everything. But he was darn good at it.
Yeah. And he was
there's no one better.
I know it. And I love the way he would turn his eye on himself and with humor and very gentle humor. I don't think I've read a mean word out of that man's pen ever. No need to be mean. No need. Just no excuse for it either. And just, you know, such a vivid picture of Vermont, both the natural world, the people who occupy it, the things that they are lovable for.
Right.
Like Leonard Cohen talks about the crack where the light gets in. I mean, we saw that in all the people that he...
Yeah, and again, that is his Vermont stuff. There's so much more with him than just the Vermont stuff. Yeah. There's the work that you were reading, the Buddhism-type Tao stuff.
The Tao stuff, yep.
So, yeah, the Vermont thing we tend to, or I tend to think about or talk about, but there's all that the rest of it that's as good.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know?
I did
a play he wrote called Thingy World that was about
What's
commercialization.
That? I don't know that one. Thingy
commercialization,
World?
Yeah, we did it at Trinity. And yeah, a bunch of us did it. And,
was it poetry?
Good.
Was it
no?
The way Judah Vine is?
No, it was still had rhythm.
It had yeah, I'm sure it
still
did.
Had the rhythm,
but it was more a narrative kind of a
yeah. So
Thingy World, he just completed something on his relationship with his father. I thought. Too.
I mean, Songs for My Father
God
darn it, that was excellent. Lost Nation did that.
Okay.
Bob Nooner was played in that, and another. Oh my God, that was wicked good.
I see that.
Songs for My Father is about his father's death and everything, and now I see.
Yeah.
See what's weird about it?
Yeah. Well, he has a number of poems where he talks about that psychiatric thing. It's pretty amazing. Listen, Rusty, I know this was short notice, and you're a really good egg to come in, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, I'd do anything, for David Budbill.
Okay, good to know.
And I will say, I know you're counting down, but please, I'm not trying to sell. Nope. I'll sell for me. Look,
go
I got a show October 1st.
Yes, let's hear about that.
It's a benefit for Good Samaritan Haven at the Barry Elks. So go to Next Chapter Bookstores, buy tickets for that because it supports shelter, but buy a David Budbill book. You will be glad you did give them as gifts. I don't need to sell his stuff. I'm saying do it for yourself. It's good.
Yep. A recommendation from one friend to another. I'm telling you, too. Same thing. Just tremendous and a real loss for the state of Vermont. And we thank you, David Budbill, for your life and for your work, which stays with us. Right now, it's about a minute and a half in front of 11 o'clock. Tom's looking at me, looking slightly relieved that we finally got around to thinking about maybe the hour's over. We could have gone on for another hour,
sure,
about this guy.
We could have read a lot more.
Yeah, we could read a lot more. Maybe we should do that at some point, but this seems to have been the opportunity. I do need to tell you that you are... Where's my shopping list? Here it is. It's got the 1 minute left. I do need to tell you that you are listening to WDEV News Radio, broadcasting at 96.1 from the top of Sugarbush in Warren, 96.5 in Barrie, over the independently owned airwaves at 101.9 in Island Pond, and now... fresh and spanky, squeaky, clean new signal in Montpelier, 98.3 FM. And as always, broadcasting at the Nifty 550 AM 550 WDEV, the flagship station right here in Waterbury.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com. And you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.